Bitco is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. Bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
Honey, why can't I download any more series?
Dad, my game just bombed.
Daddy, I was speaking to Kevin and my call just cut out.
With uncapped box fiber to the home, reaching your cap is a thing of the past. You can have all your devices connected all the time. Get unlimited browsing, unlimited calling, and unlimited entertainment. Box Fiber. Now uncapped. T's and C's apply. For more information, visit box.co.za.
I'm Duncan MacLeod, and you're listening to the Tech Central podcast. I'm on an internet call today with none other than Simon Dingle, who I don't think requires too much introduction to our listeners. Simon, of course, is a former tech journalist, longtime podcaster, speaker, and technologist, and now published author who is fascinated by the world of cryptocurrencies. So, Simon, it's been a while since we last spoke. Thanks so much for talking to Tech Central today. What have you been up to over the last couple of years?
I've been sort of firmly focused on the world of fintech and getting my hands dirty with building fintech products. I joined the team with 22/7 back in 2012, which is around the time I think we had our last conversations on a podcast about the cost of laying fiber compared to laying other things, etc. And 22/7 was quite a big learning curve for me in terms of actually putting my I don't know if my money where my mouth is, I suppose, not really, but actually getting my hands dirty with building technology. After that, I joined a company called Bitex, which is now called Luno. I was on the team there when we were just a few guys in a room in Stellenbosch building what was one of the first Bitcoin exchanges in the world. And after that, a company called Curve in the UK, where we launched a smart credit card. And I run my two own companies, Phantom Design and Invest Capital, which are both sort of very firmly focused on getting new products to market and with a specialization in fintech.
Great. What do those two companies do exactly?
So Phantom Design designs products and gets them built. Invest Capital funds projects in the space. So at a high level, that's what both of them do.
Okay. So we are live streaming today, so please use the Spreaker chat room to post any comments or questions you may have. Better yet, send us your questions via WhatsApp, either text or a voice note, which we can include on air. The number to use is 071-999-1111. Store that number in your phone for future podcasts. The number again, 071-999-1111. And please do send us your questions. We'll include them in the show today if you're listening live. So, Simon, you have a book out. It's called In Math We Trust, Bitcoin, Cryptocurrencies, and the Journey to Being Your Own Bank. First of all, congratulations on the book. I've just finished reading it. It's a quick three-hour read, or possibly a bit less, but it's information-rich, and it's quite clear you are a cryptocurrency true believer, I think it's fair to say. Let's talk a bit about the book and why you wrote it. Who in your view should be reading this?
So I'll give you the sort of answer that I think too many product creators and authors give you, which is everyone. but that was really what I had in mind when I was writing it. My publisher, Tracy McDonald, approached me last year to write the book. And I think, you know, cryptocurrency, it's quite a broad subject. And I think, unfortunately, people tend to talk about things like Bitcoin and ICO tokens in a single breath when they are very different things. But it's perceived as being a very complex subject. And the idea was to write a book that A, simplified it, B, didn't waste people's time, but also that didn't intimidate people with what is already quite a complicated subject. I think if you walk into a bookstore and you see a hefty tome on the shelf with 1,000 pages about, you know, Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, that would probably turn most people off. So the intention was to write something that you could, you know, perhaps read in an afternoon or two, that was quite dense with facts, but also quite simple to understand.
Great. You describe yourself quite early on in the book, and this is a phrase that I stopped and paused a bit when I read. You describe yourself as a libertarian socialist. Aren't those two concepts mutually exclusive?
Well, that's the interesting thing, is they aren't. And this was a term that was introduced to me by one of these ridiculous online surveys I did. So, you know, these quizzes that have become famous because of the Cambridge Analytica scandal. But, you know, where your friends will post to Facebook, take this quiz and find out what your political stance is. And I did that. And it turns out that I'm aligned with the movement of social libertarianism. The only famous social libertarian I could find was Noam Chomsky. So fairly good company, But yes, it is quite an interesting combination of ideas, because while on the one hand, you know, the notion is that we have a problem with authority figures, we also believe in collaborating around social good. And it becomes a fairly long discussion about why those ideas aren't mutually exclusive, but I don't believe they are.
Okay. So what exactly does a libertarian socialist believe?
So I'm going to give you my personal belief, because I don't want to speak for others. And I don't quite, you know, I haven't exactly studied the doctrine of social libertarianism. That's simply what a quiz said I am. But I do believe that governments have too much power. I do believe that we have too much of our trust vested in third parties and authorities that have betrayed it over time. And we've seen that betrayal come in various forms, from outright war to, you know, collapses in financial systems. So I believe that governments have too much power on the one hand, while on the other hand, I don't believe they're actually doing enough in terms of social good. It depends which country we turn the torch onto. But, you know, the United States and South Africa are two examples where government wields power for the wrong reasons too often, and for the right reasons almost never at all. And so I believe it's possible to build a society in which, on the one hand, governments don't have too much power, and that, you know, we as citizens have checks and balances in place on those governments, while on the other hand, providing sort of healthcare and education and other services that are much needed in terms of the social goods. So that would be the summary of it, I suppose.
Okay. You suggest in your book that the world's monetary systems have done enormous good for the world, but that they are also perhaps fundamentally flawed at the same time. Perhaps take us
through... they're an experiment.
Perhaps take us through how money as a concept has evolved over thousands of years, and then why you believe the current system is ripe for disruption.
Great. So I think evolved is exactly the right word, because this is something that we're sort of figuring out as we go along. And if you trace the roots of money all the way back to as far as we can anthropologically, they arrive on the scene at just about the same point as language does. We were all taught stories about the barter system and how early human beings traded goods with each other. But the barter system was never in widespread use, because it has a problem with currency, actually, with being current in time. So if I've got a perishable good and I want to trade it for your perishable goods, you know, that transaction relies on both of those goods being in consumable form at the time of the trade. So, for example, if I've just caught a fish and you're a mealie farmer and I want to swap some fish for your mealies, well, then I have to have just caught the fish at the time that your mealies are ready to harvest, and that's almost never the case. And so even in, you know, the earliest societies as human beings, we've always been coming up with tokens of trust with a form of money or IOU notes that we could use to solve that problem. I could take the fish to you today and you could give me something that if I brought back when the mealies were ready to harvest, I could exchange for it. And so money is arguably the oldest game we play as humanity, but I think we sometimes lose sight of the fact that it is a game. It only works because of the mythology that it relies upon. It's a set of rules that we all agree to. So if you imagine, you know, you and I playing chess, everything goes fine while we're agreed on the rules. But if I said to you, Duncan, I'm going to start moving all my pawns like queens, you know, that game would very quickly transform for you if you insisted on playing by the old rules. And so every now and then these seismic change in rules do come along, and they're either enforced by governments and armies, or just by a social movement that's too big to curb. And they inject a new rule set. And if enough people play by those rules, well, then it changes the game for those people at first, but, you know, perhaps for society at large over time. And I think that's what fascinates me about cryptocurrency as an evolution of human trust, is we've been presented with a new rule set, and there's quite a large group of us now playing by those rules. And if more and more people start playing by those rules, then it can replace the current system. why this won't work. But these are the same people who told us that the internet wouldn't work or that people wouldn't swap their horses for cars or history is littered with cynics who are wrong. But that fascinates me. The fact that money is a game in the first place and that it exists only in human mythology in itself is a philosophical fascination. But how it's evolving now is even more so.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. I really enjoyed the section in your book, by the way, Simon, that dealt with Bitcoin's, and I'll use the word apparent creator, the now legendary Satoshi Nakamoto. You mentioned that there are plenty of theories out there about who he is, but no one really knows for sure, right? What are some of those theories? Do expound on a few of them in your book.
Well, the theory that is probably closest to the truth is that it was a computer scientist by the name of Dave Kleinman who passed away a few years ago. That would explain several things, not least of which the fact that Satoshi has gone quiet and that nobody has heard from Satoshi until 2011. So the fact that Satoshi's dead might be an explanation. But I think the other point I make is that it ultimately doesn't matter who Satoshi was, because whoever this person or group of people, which is even more likely actually, was, they had the wherewithal and the foresight to realize that it was important to be anonymous. And I think that's also one of the things that sets Bitcoin apart from other cryptocurrencies, and it's a fact that's often overlooked, is we get carried away with the technical aspects of a cryptocurrency and what makes it superior in terms of perhaps privacy or security, etc. But what matters more than any of that is the story it tells, the narrative. And in the narrative of Bitcoin, this founder is the pseudonymous character who's beyond death, who's beyond, public scandal, for example. And if you look at publicly listed companies, I think you and I were both watching Apple very closely in the final years of Steve Jobs' life. And every time he got rushed to hospital, the share price would take a dip. To hit a bit closer to home, we've got the Ethereum cryptocurrency, which was founded by a guy by the name of Vitalik Buterin. Last year, there was a rumor that Vitalik had died in a car crash and it sent the price of Ethereum tumbling. One can imagine the founder of a company, for example, being outed as part of the Me Too movement and turning out to be a bit of a pest, in which case support for that company would probably wane as a result. And as we've seen in the creative world with Hollywood directors, et cetera, who've been outed and people don't engage with their work anymore, and probably rightfully so. But it's quite interesting that a component of Bitcoin is the pseudonymity of the founder. Nobody knows who he or she or they are, and so they're beyond these problems. They're beyond dying in car crashes or of cancer, or being outed in a public scandal. And that is Bitcoin, a special magic that most other cryptocurrencies don't have. It also makes it closer to real world currencies that rely on mythology and rely on trusting God and nation states and things that don't exist. So it bolsters the narrative around Bitcoin. And I think for me, that's the real fascination of Satoshi Nakamoto.
So tell us a bit about crypto money. Let's get back to basics here. How does it differ from so-called fiat money or money that is printed by governments beyond the fact that it is encrypted and entirely digital?
Look, I suppose it depends on which cryptocurrency we're talking about. In my book, I focus on Bitcoin, not exclusively, but when it comes to talking about sound money, Bitcoin is really still the best example that we've got. So if we look at the differences between that and what is referred to in the space as fiat currency, fiat, of course, is a Latin term, which means let it be done. Or as I say in the book, you could also interpret it as because I say so. And that's really why money works in modern states, is because the government says so. You have to pay your taxes in this currency, and you have to accept it, more importantly, as a settlement of debt. And that's the definition of what economists refer to as legal tender, is money that must be accepted for the settlement of debt, and that then becomes your national currency. So it comes from a central bank, usually in 99% of the cases. And central banks, or like the Federal Reserve in the United States, have the right to issue more money. So it essentially gets printed on demand. Of course, it's not quite that simple in practice, but it's something that comes out of thin air that we use because the government told us we have to, and that more can be made of because, for example, there's a requirement for quantitative easing, which is when, central banks inject more money into a system to solve a problem, like we saw in the fallout of the 2009 financial crisis or 2008 financial crisis, depending on when you start the clock. But, you know, governments were printing money on overdrive to solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because of the laws of supply and demand, that means that, you know, fiat currency is inflationary and things tend to become more expensive, priced in fiat currency over time. And in the extreme case, you get something like the Italian lira, where things start out costing one or two of the currency and end up costing hundreds of thousands of it. And then a new system emerges from that. The opposite is true in cryptocurrency. So firstly, there's no central bank. We've got an open and transparent system of secured ledgers that all correspond with each other as to what transactions have happened in the system, and that produce new units of the currency according to an algorithm that makes it harder to produce those units the more computing power is trying to do so. Which means that over time, less and less Bitcoin enters the system until it hits a finite amount. And in the case of Bitcoin, that'll be 21 million Bitcoin that'll ever be minted, if you will. Mm. And the system will stop producing new units of the currency at that point. So there's the next big difference from fiat currency is that because of that, Bitcoin is deflationary, which means that single units of the currency tend to become more valuable over time as opposed to less valuable, which is what happens with fiat currencies. It also means that it's beyond the control of a government. There's no decision making that can be brought to bear on the network by politicians. So they can't decide that we need more Bitcoin, so let's just make it so. And I suppose those are sort of the chief differences. You can think of Bitcoin as being a solution to central banking if you believe that central banking is a problem.
Right, and I think you do, Simon.
I think components of it are. Mm. So you know that's a very deep philosophical discussion. But I undoubtedly believe that Bitcoin is a better system.
Yeah, I mean this is really the first time that we're seeing a competitor emerging to fiat currencies. Fiat currencies have really been monopolies in the markets in which they're printed, and now we're entering an environment where fiat currencies have a competitor. Why did we allow a situation to persist for so long where only one fiat currency existed in a particular market? I mean, if we believe in the free market, surely even our monetary system should be competing.
Yes, I agree, and it's a difficult question to answer. I mean, if you think about it, really, Bitcoin is closer to the way we originally dealt with money than fiat currency is. If you look at the full extent of human history, fiat currency is actually more of a modern idea
right.
Than the basics of Bitcoin, which has people transacting in a peer-to-peer network, which, of course, is how we originally transacted. We would have tokens like seashells or tally sticks, etc., and in ancient tribes and societies, we could transact directly with each other and we didn't have to clear it through a central authority. So the competing idea with fiat currency is actually an ancient one. I think that the problem that it had was that it didn't scale. It worked very well in small societies or tribes with, you know, not more than 100 or 150 individuals. And in anthropology, they refer to Dunbar's number, which is the sort of limit on the amount of individuals that anyone can deal with in an organizational unit like a tribe. The moment that number gets more than 100 or 150, new tribes tended to break off or new organizational units tend to break off in companies. So it's just one of those limitations of the human brain. In those tiny societies, peer-to-peer cash and tokens worked fine without a computing system to help it scale. But of course, we needed governments and central banking and banks and all the rest of it to scale economies. So I think the reason that Bitcoin or something like it didn't emerge before is because without governments or a central bank behind that currency, how would it scale or how would it effectively meet the needs of millions of people? And in solving the Byzantine generals problem in computer science, for the first time we were able to digitize something like the Bitcoin network and have digital stores of value, which didn't exist before. And so that really gave us the technological edge in creating something better than a fiat currency.
Okay. Without Bitcoin, do you think the global financial system, I mean, we saw what happened in 2008 with the global financial crisis, governments printing money, the so-called quantitative easing process. Would you go so far as to say that the global financial system is in some way broken now and can't be fixed and therefore Bitcoin is going to fill this gap, or do you think the global financial system will right itself in the coming decades?
You know, it's almost impossible to answer the question, Duncan, because we don't know what we don't know about the future. Mm. You know, nobody really saw the subprime crisis coming. Financial events that led to turmoil in world markets. Mm. And because we don't know what the next one will be, it's very difficult to preempt where the system is going. But I think what I feel fairly certain about is that all that aside, Bitcoin offers us a better alternative. I like the idea of money that's deflationary. I like the idea of a global currency because all of this nonsense around borders and debt between countries, et cetera, just seems nonsensical to me. And it seems like a better way of us transacting or for us to transact with each other. So, you know, as I say in the book, it's not that the current system is terrible. It's served us quite well in some aspects. It's failed us in others. You know, we undoubtedly live better lives than people did 100, 200, or 300 years ago as a result of, you know, a system of free markets, et cetera. Unfortunately, that statement isn't universal, but it's true for the most part. So, you know, I'm not one of those sort of crypto anarchists who believes that there's nothing good or redeeming about the current system.
Right.
I just do think that there's too much power. I do think that it's failed us. And I do think that regardless of all of the benefits it has offered us, Bitcoin is still a superior system that deserves more airtime.
Okay. Now, Simon, many people have argued that Bitcoin is more of an asset than a currency in that few people are using it for day-to-day transactions. You can't walk into your local Checkers or Spa today and buy your bread and milk using a cryptocurrency. Is that going to change at some point? Will central banks allow it? And what will be the trigger that sees mass adoption?
So that's a fascinating question, especially now in 2018 as Bitcoin is getting closer to the phase of its evolution as a medium of exchange. And it's quite interesting because you sit with a chicken and egg scenario in the early days of a cryptocurrency. Why will people want it in the first place if they can't do anything with it? But before you can do anything with it, it has to be valuable. And so whether by design or a complete fluke, the fact that Bitcoin wasn't good for microtransactions, for example, really helped it in its early days because it meant that people weren't spending it, but they were hanging on to it. And because it's deflationary, the more and more people that got added to the network, the more and more valuable the units became. And it attracted traders. It became volatile. And it meant that people were putting value into the system, but they weren't taking that value out of the system. Mm. Now, that turns out to be very good for something like Bitcoin, which needs to build up sufficient value before it can be an effective medium of exchange. Unfortunately, it means that it has led a lot of the community astray. And I think there are too many people now that describe Bitcoin as digital gold and think that that is all it's good for, is storing value. Forgetting that Satoshi Nakamoto's original intention for Bitcoin, and in the very first thing he or she ever said about it, is that Bitcoin was designed to be electronic peer-to-peer cash that doesn't rely on a third party. And so there are a few things on the horizon that I think will help to get Bitcoin there. One of them is the Lightning Network coming online, which is a new protocol layer that really does make it cheap enough to transact with Bitcoin. And so, you know, that on a technological level means that Bitcoin will become cheaper and more desirable for retailers to implement, for example, and that it'll probably stimulate more people to spend it. Obviously, another thing that needs to happen is that we need to see the price volatility settle down and we need to see some stability coming to the price of Bitcoin. The more and more people hold it and, you know, use it, the more that volatility will decrease. But that also is a bit of a chicken and egg scenario because, you know, you need more people to use Bitcoin for it to be stable, and you need it to be stable in order for more people to use it. So it's sort of, you know, seesaws up. It becomes slightly more stable, more people enter the network, and as they do so, it pushes up the stability. But it does mean that it's an extremely slow process. Mm. But I'm one of those people who believes in the original intention for Bitcoin, for it to be money. Unfortunately, fortunately, actually, it doesn't really matter, but it's going to have to scale like the internet did through protocol layers. We know that this nature of network doesn't scale in single fat protocols. It actually needs additional protocols to scale. But I think Bitcoin is on track to do that. And in the case of Bitcoin, the Lightning Network is probably the biggest reason to believe that it'll become not only a good store of value, but also a good medium of exchange, and perhaps in not too long.
Do you think that regulators, and I'm specifically thinking of the central bank in South Africa's example, the South African Reserve Bank, will try and block the adoption of Bitcoin as a transactional currency in the retail environment, for example? Or do you think they'll allow it to carry on and see how it develops?
I think they'll allow it to carry on for now. If you look at the sounds that the South African Reserve Bank have made, they've been quite open to innovation in the space. They certainly haven't dismissed cryptocurrency.
Yeah.
One of the things that they have done, unfortunately, is that they don't class it as a currency. So they've put it in the sort of intangible asset class, and our local tax regulator is treating it as such. So they refuse to appreciate it as a currency, which sets us apart from a country like Japan that has acknowledged it as currency. But they're an outlier. Most countries have taken this tack of this is a digital asset. It's intangible, but it's certainly not a currency. Will they try and stop it? I think if they believed that it was a threat to their existence, which it was designed to be, then they would. But I don't think that they see that happening yet. I don't think they take that threat seriously. Mm-hmm. I think that they see the technology as being something that they could potentially use themselves and incorporate into their own systems. And a more interesting question is as to whether or not they could stop it. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we've seen governments try to stop the flow of information on the internet before, which is essentially what's happening with Bitcoin, and fail miserably in doing so, whether it's the Great Firewall in China or whether it's legal entities trying to stop online content piracy. It almost never succeeds because peer-to-peer networks are a little bit like cupping water. The more control you try and assume on the network, the more the network roots around you and essentially just ignores you. So what solved content piracy, because that really is a solved problem, was companies like Apple and Netflix applying themselves to the problem and going, you know what, people are expressing a need here. They're not pirating content because they're necessarily criminals and they don't want to pay for things. It's that they don't have any other option in some parts of the world to get hold of that content, or they can't get hold of it in the manner that they'd wish to. And so, you know, what we learned with content piracy is that convenient beats free.
Mm.
And I think if we look at the world of cryptocurrency, there's a need being expressed by a large and growing amount of people that are solving the problem themselves online. It's too easy to dismiss them as sort of anarchists and rebels, although we certainly are that for the most part, maybe. but there's a need being expressed, and can regulators meet that need? I am fairly convinced that they can't tackle it technically or economically. They might be able to tackle it on a communications front, but even that seems doubtful. So I don't see a practical way for them to stop it, but I do imagine that there are ways for them to play along or to incorporate parts of it or to appreciate this need that's being expressed and play to that. And then, of course, your reactions to that depend on where you fall on that spectrum of crypto anarchy.
Is there not an argument, though, Simon, to be made that there needs to be regulation to protect consumers? We've heard of the high-profile hacking of crypto exchanges where hundreds of millions of dollars have been stolen. This has resulted in calls for government to get involved in regulating crypto assets to protect people. Is this wrong-headed?
I think the intention is good. It's one of those very tricky things. You know, if we look at credit card fraud, for example, it still is a rather large problem. And the reason that more people aren't speaking about it, perhaps, is because, you know, banks have solved the problem by effectively just refunding people every time it happens, right? You just make sure that nobody's actually losing any money. But the problem hasn't gone away. Every day credit cards are skimmed, numbers are stolen, and a lot of money is spent online and elsewhere, you know, using that compromised data. So consumers definitely do need to be protected. But in the most part, it's from the same people who were conducting scams in the old world of money with credit cards and debit orders, with fake documents, with phishing attacks from websites. The problems aren't different now. I don't think that crime has taken on a new order of magnitude thanks to cryptocurrency. It's not like criminals had a problem with the old world of money. So I definitely think that the intention of regulators to protect consumers is good. I think that unfortunately a lot of criminals on the edge of the network sort of operating as cryptocurrency exchanges where they weren't really, for example, or running pyramid schemes. consumers need to be protected from that. But the problem is the same as we've always had with scammers like Triple M Global, with pyramid schemes, with, you know, people who really didn't have them. So for me, it's almost an aside in the discussion of cryptocurrencies.
Okay. Something you touched on in your book, which I was hoping you could expand on a little bit, is the number of cryptocurrencies out there now. There are thousands of them, right?
Yes.
Will that always be the case, or is there going to be consolidation? Will one cryptocurrency emerge as the really dominant form of money in the future? And if so, will it be Bitcoin or something else?
You know, the sort of, I want to say that there'll be consolidation, but it's quite interesting because we've seen a bit of a Cambrian explosion and there are a lot of experiments going on. And again, I don't think one can talk about cryptocurrency in a single breath. So if you look at Bitcoin, which was designed to be a better form of money, designed to be electronic cash, that's very different from something like Ethereum, which was designed for more general purpose use as a sort of a global computer, if you will, that could replace the infrastructure that currently is occupied by sort of an Amazon Web Services. And that then is very different from the resulting ICO tokens that have been generated to raise funds for startups, for example. So there are a lot of different cryptocurrencies with different uses. And when it comes to money, for example, and something like Bitcoin being a good store of value as sort of the base currency for the entire cryptocurrency ecosystem, I think there'll be a lot of consolidation there. But I don't think that there'll be consolidation in the ICO space.
I wanted to ask you whether Bitcoin has any inherent disadvantages that might cause it to lose its lead in the cryptocurrency space. Do you think there are any disadvantages that another product, another cryptocurrency might bring to the table that could cause it to lose its leading position?
Look, there are several, but if I look at all of the other better than Bitcoin in inverted commas projects that have come to the fore, I haven't really seen any that, at least not in my book, would replace Bitcoin or have inspired me more than Bitcoin has. You know, the leading competitor for some people would be Bitcoin Cash, which is a fork of Bitcoin and is trying to scale it on the blockchain. So, you know, creating larger blocks for Bitcoin instead of scaling it through protocols, which is what we know works from our experience in the internet, for example. Also trying to hijack the name, unfortunately. With very little legitimacy. I don't see that project succeeding in time. It's doing what it did in our simulations. Big blocks don't work. We pretty much know that. You know, Ethereum, I don't think, is a competitor to Bitcoin. I think it's something that exists alongside it and meets a different purpose. So I believe it has its own right to exist, and I don't see it as being a zero-sum game between Bitcoin and Ethereum. So, to my mind, there aren't many. The privacy coins are interesting. So, Monero, for example, that's quite an interesting cryptocurrency because it's private. But that's a feature that Bitcoin may have in time, thanks to a technology like Dandelion, for example, that would make Bitcoin as private as something like Monero, if not more so. And I think that's the important thing about Bitcoin as a movement and a technology is, when something better comes along, it doesn't necessarily negate Bitcoin. It can be incorporated into Bitcoin. If we come up with a better proof of work system than we currently have, for example, than what the blockchain currently operates as, theoretically Bitcoin could adopt that and could move to that. So again, if one steps away from the technology and looks at the narrative, I really do believe that Bitcoin has the best story to tell so far. And that goes to what I said earlier about Satoshi Nakamoto being pseudonymous. You know, I think that that lends Bitcoin a massive advantage. The fact that if you could walk up to just about anybody on the street and ask them if they'd heard of Bitcoin and they'd say yes, whereas they probably haven't heard of a number of the other cryptocurrencies.
Greg, you were talking about private coins. I just wanted to get your views. Monero, for example, these sort of coins are not going to be the friends of nation state governments or tax collectors, etc. Do you see a big pushback against these totally anonymous coins by regulators?
I think if they ever got big enough in widespread adoption that they were big enough to be taken seriously, then certainly they would. The reality at the moment is that, you know, while there is hundreds of billions of dollars rather in cryptocurrency, There isn't enough that any regulator is sort of looking at it and sort of sitting up in their chair and going, we need to stop this now. But certainly if something like Monero did get big enough that it looked like we had a significant portion of society, you know, putting billions of dollars into it, then I think certainly you would get regulators starting to worry quite a lot at the fact that it's completely anonymous. Look, so are cash transactions, but they all get settled back through the central banking system. The interesting thing about cryptocurrency, of course, is that it can work in the same way. So you can have offline transactions, and you can even have things like paper wallets being exchanged that are then settled back through the blockchain at a later date. But I just think, you know, at the moment it's just not big enough for regulators to worry about. That will probably change in time, and it'll be interesting to see their reactions then.
Okay. I wanted to ask about, and I know you touch on it very briefly in your book, but a lot of critics have said that Bitcoin mining is unsustainable because of the huge amount of electricity that it consumes. Is there not a better and more environmentally friendly way of producing crypto money?
Yeah, I love this discussion because it forces us to talk about, you know, the bigger picture. And I don't think that the media has done a great job, actually, of covering the whole Bitcoin resource discussion. You know, the claim was made that mining a single Bitcoin consumes as much electricity as an American household does in a year. That's not entirely true. A single block has roughly 1,000 transactions in it. And look, you can't dispute that Bitcoin does consume a lot of electricity. What isn't discussed is how much electricity is consumed by the system it was designed to replace. So if we took all of our current banking infrastructure, bank branches, ATMs, for example, bank offices in cities like New York left with the lights on all night, executive workforces with private jets, et cetera, if you look at the resources being consumed by that entire system, I don't know what they are, but I'm willing to bet that they're orders of magnitude more than what Bitcoin would consume even at scale. So that's the one side of the discussion. The other side of the discussion is that you get nothing for free. Everything requires, you know, electricity or resources to run, obviously. And electricity doesn't necessarily have to be dirty. At the moment, a lot of the Bitcoin that is mined is done so on hydroelectric power in China. Of course, we can have discussions about the origins of the hydroelectric power programs in China and how humane they were, etc. But the fact is that they aren't being generated by burning coal or even through nuclear energy. Iceland is another popular country for Bitcoin mining operations because of their thermonuclear power, which offers, you know, gigawatts of clean, sustainable energy. So there are ways to do this cleanly. Unfortunately, there aren't ways to do this easily. Consensus should be hard. We want a system that we can rely upon. We need something that we can trust. And so for that, you know, not for that reason, but that reason comes from the fact that Bitcoin is very difficult to mine. And while it should be, that's why it's so secure. That's why its encryption can be trusted at the level that it is. That's why it becomes more secure in time. So I actually see that as a feature of Bitcoin, not as something that's detrimental. I think that we increasingly are moving on to clean power. We are driving new efficiencies into the network. Improvements like SegWit, for example, which was a technology that was introduced to the Bitcoin network some months ago, that considerably reduced the size of transactions and meant that we could mine more transactions in a block. So on the one hand, you've got Bitcoin becoming more efficient and more optimized. On the other hand, you've got us increasingly moving to sustainable power. And then you've got the other aspect of the discussion, which is how much power is being consumed by the systems that Bitcoin is designed to replace.
Let's say the world moves entirely away from currencies, from fiat currencies to crypto money, or even significantly in that direction. What does that mean for the world economy and the way humans transact? Human beings have arranged themselves around a system of nation states, each with their own monetary systems. What does it mean for the global economic and political order if there is a massive disruption to the system? Are nation state governments really going to let it go easily? And is there a potential for a global conflict?
I don't know about conflict, but the optimist in me is, if I start thinking about it from a tax perspective, for example, you know, the tax system is a bit messy at the moment. It relies on a lot of trust between government and its citizens because the onus is on you to report your earnings, etc. And yes, government can audit you, but it doesn't have the resources to audit everybody en masse. And so there's already a lot of trust that's required. There's already a lot of opacity. And I suspect there are a lot of people getting away with paying a lot less tax than they should be on the one hand. On the other hand, there's very little accountability from government side, and we see the misappropriation of funds in countries like South Africa, the ridiculous systems of lobbying in the States, etc., and the ridiculous things that tax money gets spent on, like bailing out banks in 2009, which I would venture was not the best use of taxpayers' money, besides the fact that no taxpayer had any say in that event happening. And so if I look at it through the lens of tax, if we imagine a future where there's a country, that's a system that, as transparent as the ledgers are, even with something like Bitcoin, it can be quite tricky for authorities to snoop on the network and to determine how much money you actually have. You know, it's not a bank account where they literally are the reason the bank exists and they can go and query the ledger. And so that raises some very interesting possibilities. On the one hand, it means that they, if they really want to catch somebody, if they suspect that there's a criminal or terrorist or whatever operation, and they apply enough resources to the problem, the blockchain gives them just enough information that at a large enough scale, they can go and find the person that they're looking for. And we've seen this happen with something like the Onion Router that was designed to give people anonymous internet access, in short. But criminals have been caught through the Onion Router when there's been an authority that's wanted them bad enough to commit millions of dollars to catching them. And I'd argue that that's the way it should be, right? So you've got that on the one hand. On the other hand, if you're not able to just step in and query anybody's financial universe, you'd have to compel them to pay taxes beyond the threat of an audit or, potential criminal proceedings. Mm. I have this fundamental belief that, many cynics will roll their eyes at, that most people aren't assholes, that most people do believe in, doing things in the public good, et cetera, and that if they're receiving the services that improve their lives, they'll be willing to pay their taxes. And so I see government services perhaps improving should something like cryptocurrency scale, because governments will have to earn their keep and they'll have to compel us to pay our taxes. It'll be something that we have to be complicit in and that we will have to want to do. And so what does a government look like in that reality? What does it look like when we are compelled to pay our taxes, and what does a government have to be to get us to do that? I don't have the answer to that question, but I think it's an interesting thought experiment.
I do wonder how many people will willingly pay their taxes if it's voluntary.
Yeah.
So, Simon, before I let you go, I wanted to ask you, does crypto money have any real downsides? Are there risks that it could end up increasing rather than decreasing global inequality and dividing the world, for example, between those with the technical nous to understand it and those who are confused by it all?
That's a great question. And, effectively what some have argued the cryptocurrency landscape is doing right now is that it's creating a new 1% in the 1%. I think that'll be short-lived, and I think that over time cryptocurrency offers some massive opportunities for financial inclusion, for example. The banking system at the moment precludes millions of people who just can't get bank accounts even if they wanted them. The bank can't afford to have them as customers because it doesn't know how to make money from them. They simply just don't earn enough, etc. And so their lives are compromised because they're excluded from the digital economy. Whereas something like the Bitcoin blockchain doesn't discriminate, will allow anybody to create a wallet and to begin transacting. It doesn't care how much money you're storing on it. It can be a few rands. That's fine. And so I think if we look far enough down the line, in the short term, yes, it'll be the playground of the rich and powerful, which any new technology is. The first people who had cars were super rich. The first people who had toilets were super rich, electricity, etc. That's where it starts because, inherently anything new is expensive. Over time, as we see that changing and it being used more as a medium of exchange, for example, and it becoming more accessible, I think that it has more to offer the world in terms of financial inclusion over the long term than the opposite of that statement.
Okay. Before I let you go, I don't know if you're prepared to do this, but if you are, what would you venture the price of Bitcoin being by the end of this year?
I don't know about the end of this year, but I'll give you a more general sort of answer. And that is that if you look at what Bitcoin currently represents in terms of global fiat currency, you know, the sort of leading estimate is that there's about $95 trillion in the world today if you put all of the world's fiat currency together. Incidentally, global debt is over $250 billion now, which is just trillion dollars, which is just crazy.
But
the world owes, you know, more than double the amount of money in existence. But Bitcoin represents less than 0.1% in value of global monetary supply. So if Bitcoin was even just 1% successful as a global currency, it would have to be worth 10 times what it is today. So that's an interesting way to look at it. My personal feeling is that the bear market will return and that things are gonna float around the $10,000 mark for the rest of this year. But, you know, there are people predicting $45,000 by the end of 2018 and $50,000, some people predicting more than that and some people predicting nothing. I tend to focus on the year and now and not to get too carried away with the price because I'm more interested in the technology and the societal movement. But my feeling is that we're not going to see any major movement in the price before next year.
Okay, so I've got some time still to get in. I'm still not a
perhaps
Bitcoin.
Or lose it all.
What do they call it? Hodler. A Bitcoin hodler.
Hodler, yeah.
At some point, I'm going to have to buy some and start dabbling. But Simon, thanks so much for talking to us today. Your book, In Math We Trust. I bought my copy on my Amazon Kindle. It's available in print as well. I presume it's available at all good bookstores around South Africa.
Yes, it's in Exclusive Books, CNA, lots of independent bookstores and available online, as you said, for Amazon Kindle.
Great. Simon Dingle is author of In Math We Trust. Simon, congratulations on the book and thanks so much for talking to Tech Central today.
Thanks, Duncan.